From claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt.
EWTN Radio presents The Miracle Hunter with Michael O'Neill.
Welcome to the Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm The Miracle Hunter. We've got a great show ahead for you today, and it's a fun one for me. People who listen to this show know I love trivia, and I really like Catholic pub trivia. We have a segment on each and every show, and there's a great new book out that's going to be some fodder for future questions on this show. It's called Catholicism Everywhere, and that's brought to you by Dr. Helen Hoffner and Sophia Institute Press. It's a fun one. I'm looking forward to that interview with Dr. Hoffner later in the program to find out some of the various ways that Catholicism has influenced and inspired some things big and small in our society and the world. And later in the show, we'll be talking with John Clark about the miraculous staircase of St. Joseph in New Mexico. It is one of the more fascinating things we have in the United States, and one of the things that relate to St. Joseph. So in this month of St. Joseph, it's a great time to talk about that miraculous, perhaps, staircase. Check out my television series on EWTN. Next Wednesday, we'll be looking at the life of Father Nelson Baker. And there's the episode of They Might Be Saints. I'll be examining the canonization cause for Father Nelson Baker, who was a former business owner who built a world-class city of charity with an orphanage, home for troubled youth, schools, a hospital, and a basilica. That episode was absolutely amazing to film there near Buffalo, and to see the incredible work of Father Nelson Baker that still exists today. So check that one out next Wednesday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. They Might Be Saints, Father Nelson Baker. And check out Explore with the Miracle Hunter. We're in a run of new episodes. Nobody's seen this episode before. Explore with the Miracle Hunter on Saturday, the 16th at 5 p.m. We have a new episode related to Rocca Maggiore. And the Church of Rocca Maggiore houses an image and bell that, according to legend, mysteriously rings out to herald miracles happening on the high seas. I'll be investigating that. That was one of the most amazing churches I've ever been to in the entire world. So check that one out on Saturday at 5 p.m. Central Time, and that's on EWTN on Saturday the 16th. Later in the show, we're going to be looking at the 365 Days with Mary project. For today, we've got Our Lady of the Miracle from Motta di Lavenza in Italy in the year 1510. And the might-be saint of the day is Blessed Battista of Florence. And the question of the week is an interesting one. Is it true that DNA cannot be extracted from Eucharistic miracles? I'll do my best to answer that one later in the show. Let's take a look at the miracle news. We do this every week. We talk about miracles happening around the world and those things that relate to miracles. And perhaps this is not really a miracle of any sort, but it is the first time it's happened in the history of the United States. And we're talking about the first paid state holiday in any state to honor the contributions of a woman. And it's a Catholic saint at that. We're talking about, of course, Mother Cabrini and Mother Cabrini Day. And the new film Cabrini, we just featured that one on the program last week. We interviewed the executive director on that program. So check that one out to find out more about the new Cabrini film. But it is exciting. For those who don't live in the state of Colorado, they might be unfamiliar with Mother Cabrini Day, which has been celebrated since 2020, actually. It's the first state holiday ever initiated in any state to honor the contributions of a woman, and it is a Catholic saint who is being honored. And so nearly 4 years ago to this day, Colorado State Legislature met on March 10th, 2020, to vote on the Francis Xavier Cabrini House Bill, Bill 2010-31, which was meant to replace Columbus Day as a state holiday. And after its passage, the bill was sent to the desk of Governor Jared Polis, who signed it into law on March 20th, and Mother Cabrini Day has been celebrated on the first Monday of October ever since. And the holiday's dedicated webpage explains that supporters of the Cabrini Day believe in its power to uplift and unite Colorado through kindness, compassion, community-centered activities. And the website offers printable flyers so that awareness for this holiday can be spread throughout the communities. It also lists five worthy reasons to celebrate the life of St. Francis Xavier Cabrini. So, again, not a miracle, but first time in the history of the United States, Cabrini Day is being celebrated, of course, And that new film, Cabrini, is out, so people might want to check that one out. Let's take a look at Catholic Pub Trivia. We do this every week where we ask a trivia question and give out a prize, which is the Miracle Hunter image of the faces of Mary. And we talked about last week about Our Lady of the Rosary. We had an interview with Dan Cheeley, a historian, and it triggered a question, which was, what is the only Marian shrine in the world dedicated to Our Lady of the Rosary with more annual visitors than Our Lady of the Rosary of Pompeii, which I've been to? It's a beautiful church built by Blessed Bartolo Longo. But which shrine has more visitors than that one dedicated to Our Lady of the Rosary? Of course, this was one of the easier questions I've ever asked. That was Our Lady of the Rosary of Fatima in Portugal. That one has significantly more visitors. Millions upon millions visit Fatima each and every year. Today's question is about St. Joseph. We're going to be talking about St. Joseph as it relates to the St. Joseph staircase in New Mexico. The question is, what is the only time and only place in France where St. Joseph had an apparition? Again, the question is, what is the only apparition of St. Joseph in France? If you think you know that answer and want to win the prize, the image of the faces of Mary, send me an email to questions@miraclehunter.com, and maybe you'll be the winner. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with John Clark of the National Catholic Register about the miraculous staircase of St. Joseph in New Mexico.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. Well, this is a big month for devotees of St. Joseph. With his feast day coming up, it'll be upon us in no time at all. And of course, some people may celebrate this whole month in dedication to St. Joseph. Some nations, perhaps maybe even Italy or Poland, they have a great devotion nationwide to the stepfather of Christ. And when we talk about apparitions of St. Joseph and miraculous phenomena, there are some. There are some that are sprinkled throughout France and the rest of the world, these reports of miraculous happenings. But there is an occasion of something that happened according to tradition or legend or story or reality here in the United States in New Mexico. And you may have heard of this, our Loreto Chapel, which features a staircase, which according to tradition, to legend, to the story, that was built by St. Joseph himself. Well, we're so excited today to welcome Catholic author and National Catholic Register writer John Clark, who put together an article about the St. Joseph staircase, and what's being claimed there is absolutely amazing. Welcome to the show today, John.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Well, it's great to talk with you, and this is an interesting thing. As far as miracles go, we don't have quite as many here in the United States as they do in Italy or France or Spain or anywhere in Europe. So the places of alleged miracles, the Catholic ones, are pretty hard to come by. But there's one in New Mexico that's kind of eye-opening in the sense that maybe we don't know what exactly happened, but we don't know how this chapel with a staircase made by St. Joseph is there in the first place. Talk to us a little bit about the history. What has been claimed at the Loreto Chapel? How did that chapel come to be?
So the Sisters of Loreto in Santa Fe, New Mexico, back in 1873, they had a school, they were a teaching order, and in 1873, they raised $30,000 to have a chapel built. And quite a number of workers were commissioned to work on that. It took about 5 years. In 1878, the chapel was completed. It's not a huge chapel, but it's not too small either. I'm guessing after being in it, it probably seats about 300 people. But the problem with the chapel is that there was no staircase. There were two floors, so you had the choir loft to get up to, which the sisters would have clearly wanted to do. But typically, the way to do that back then would have been using a ladder. So when they built it, they didn't bother putting a staircase in because the staircase to reach 22 feet up would have taken a lot of space on the first floor. So there was no staircase. And the problem with that is that when a ladder has to ascend 22 feet from first floor to second floor, you're talking about sisters in long habits. And children, nice. And girls, as a teaching order, girls with, you know, dresses that would go basically to the floor. Now, I don't know about you or any of your listeners, but I don't like climbing ladders to go up like 5 feet to change a light bulb. So you imagine 22 feet. So they were faced with a problem. And so they turned to St. Joseph for help to try to find a carpenter who could make a staircase, because the original team of people said, we can't do it. So they turned to St. Joseph and began their prayer. And that's how the story started.
So we're talking today with John Clark about the miraculous staircase found in the Loreto Chapel in New Mexico that's been attributed to St. Joseph. And we've been talking a little bit about the backstory, the origin, why there were prayers to St. Joseph in the first place. So they had to jam this this ladder in a tight space, and it had to ascend a great height to make it easier for the sisters and others to get up to the choir loft. What happened next? How did that ladder get to be built, or that staircase get to be built?
So the sisters did something very smart. When you're in trouble, ask St. Joseph's intercession. So they said a 9-day novena to try for help. They didn't exactly know what help, you know, what form that help would come in, but they prayed. On the 9th day of the novena, a man showed up with a donkey and some apparently very rudimentary tools, and offered to build it. Now, they were pretty excited because, you know, nobody ever thought about how to do it. It took him a few months to build it. I think basically he didn't want them to see as he was building it. Like they, you know, that part of the story is a little bit unclear, but he did build this. And when it was completed, it was a 33-step, interesting number there, right? A 33-step double circular staircase with no center support. So you could build such a thing as long as it had a pole to support it. You'd be fine, you know, theoretically, as long as everything else is structurally sound. But there was no pole to support it, so it made a double circle. The sisters couldn't figure out how he had done it. Now, what's even better, I guess in some ways, that adds to the story, I should say, is that he after he built it, he disappeared. Sisters never paid him. There's no log of them writing a check to him. He was gone. They couldn't figure out how he did it. And so there were basically three miracles there. The first miracle was the builder himself. Who was it? Right. Nobody had seen him. Nobody seemed to know who he was. Some of the sisters obviously believed, and many people believe to this day, that it was St. Joseph himself. That was the first miracle. The second miracle was the structure itself. Whenever I post this online, some people will say, well, there are similar staircases in Europe. I've never seen one quite like this, and I don't know that anyone else has either. We're also, again, talking about a time before they really had power tools, right? So we're talking about the 1870s. So, you know, pretty rudimentary stuff. So that was the second miracle, is the structure. The third miracle is the wood. No one could figure out where it came from. It's a type of spruce, but it's apparently the most rare. It's the only wood of its kind. So you basically have those three miracles, and to me, it's a pretty compelling story. All these things, they couldn't figure out how it would bear any weight, and yet it did. One of the sisters walked up it, and it bore her weight. So it was functional. So all in all, that is basically the story behind the staircase itself.
Amazing. And so we're talking about a staircase that dendrologists or wood experts have looked at, and the wood is a rare type of wood. Engineers and carpenters have looked at it and say the wedge design is unique, and it doesn't use, I believe it doesn't use nails or any other kind of metal in it at some point. It's all wedged together into this helix shape, so it's quite amazing. Can people still go to this chapel today in Loreto to see the St. Joseph staircase?
They can, and about 2 years ago, I don't fly, so my wife's family lives in L.A., so if you can imagine, we drove from Florida to California, and we took our three youngest children. We have 9 children, so we took the 3 youngest, and you know, we wanted to see some interesting sights along the way. And I'd always been interested in this because my father was a carpenter. Growing up, I would just watch in amazement to see my father build things, and I mean, I didn't get the talent. I can't, you know, hammer a nail straight. But I didn't get it, but I watched my dad. But when I saw this, it reminded me a lot of that There's also something, too, I learned a lot of, you know, from my dad about wood, how much it would support, how much it wouldn't. And there's something else, too, that I find fascinating. The staircase, you know, theoretically would have been built for maybe one or maybe two sisters to climb. Mm-hmm. But there was a picture taken, I think it was in 1956. There were 15. Now, remember, it's odd to see how this staircase should support itself, mm-hmm. much less someone climbing the stairs. And yet, in the 1950s, there is a photograph I found of 15 schoolgirls, I think at a high school, in the choir, standing on the staircase all at once. Huh. 15 people. So, I mean, I guess Joseph, St. Joseph knew that was coming. But it's really amazing, and it's really stood up to a lot of its criticisms. You know, people will, because we live in a world where people sort of want to discount any and all miracles as quickly as they can, mm-hmm. right? But I have never really seen a good argument to explain any of those miracles we're talking about, the builder, the structure, the wood. I haven't seen any good arguments. And it's a wonderful thing. That, I mean, it's a beautiful staircase, too. The other thing about it that I noticed, and I want to mention, too, is that just below it, there is a confessional. And it struck me that it's really amazing, this structure, because, you know, we confess our sins as a way of climbing to heaven. And it just sort of struck me that that part of it was really, I think, just really added to the beauty of the overall, you know, structure itself.
Wonderful. We've been talking today with John Clark about the St. Joseph staircase, the miraculous staircase, as some people have said. We don't know how it got there or how it was made, who made it, where the wood came from, where the design came from. It's completely unique. It's truly a miracle. And what can we take away from this, John, as we reflect on St. Joseph in this month of March?
Well, I think the main thing is, look, turn to St. Joseph. I mean, say, you know, St. Urbanus and St. Joseph, I think particularly for men in society, you know, with all the temptations out there, you know, for men and women, but I think maybe especially for men. Turn to St. Joseph. I know as a father of nine, St. Joseph and I have gotten to be pretty good friends over the years. You know, we just have to turn to him and believe in his intercession and realize that St. Joseph is unique among the saints. You know, obviously Our Lady is, we are to offer hyperdulia, that unique honor to Our Lady. But St. Joseph has a special sort of honor is due called protodulia. So St. Joseph is, you know, unique among the saints. I mean, Our Lady is, you know, the greatest saint, but, you know, among the rest of the saints, St. Joseph. So we really should keep that in mind and realize that St. Joseph is eager to be an intercessor, you know, for Catholic fathers out there. And I think this month is just one more opportunity to really focus on that and to learn, you know, learn about St. Joseph and become friends with St. Joseph.
Wonderful connection drawn. We've been talking today with John Clark. And John, if people want to find out more about your writing, I know you write for the National Catholic Register and you are the author of books and et cetera. What's the best place for people to find you?
You know, probably a good start would just ncregister.com. I think I've got about 140 blogs up there right now. I do have a few books out there, but I would say start with the blog. I've got a lot to read about that. They could find a copy of this article, too. The article we're mentioning now is called What I Saw at the Laredo Staircase. So for a lot more detail, they can go to that and, you know, take a look and go from there.
Wonderful. Well, we're so grateful to you, John Clark, for joining us on today's program and shedding some light on the mysterious, perhaps miraculous, St. Joseph staircase. God bless.
Thank you. Thank you. God bless you.
And that was John Clark. Fascinating stuff, talking about that St. Joseph staircase in the Loreto Chapel in New Mexico. Apparently, you're able to go check that one out. So if you're driving across the country, it might be a great place to stop and something to reflect on in this month of March. We need to take a short break. But when we come back, we're going to be looking at the question of the week. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. I love getting your questions. People write in or from around the world with questions about miracles happening in today's world and those that have happened centuries ago. And I love the email questions. I get lots of them. But I also like getting questions, and I give answers when I give talks around the country. Recently, I've been giving a lot of talks related to the Eucharistic revival. I talk about Eucharistic miracles. I usually speak for about 45 minutes, and then afterwards, I answer questions for 5, 10, 15, 20 more minutes. People have questions about miracles, and I do my best to answer them. If you would like to invite me to your shrine or your parish or your event, please email me through my website, go to the contact tab, and maybe I can speak at your parish coming soon about Eucharistic miracles. Relatedly, we have a question today from Jim. It's a good one. He says, is it true that DNA cannot be extracted from Eucharistic miracles? Well, thanks, Jim, for your question. And it's an important one for people who don't know. And strangely, I think more people need to know about Eucharistic miracles. On some very rare occasions throughout the world, throughout Christian history, we have these cases where true flesh and true blood is made manifest on a consecrated host. And famously, we have Lanciano, which happened in the 700s, and we have 1996, Buenos Aires in Argentina, and Tixla in Mexico in 2006, and two in Poland that happened, and perhaps more than 100 worldwide throughout Christian history, where we have these cases of true flesh and true blood on a Eucharistic host. And what's fascinating, absolutely fascinating in my opinion, is all these hosts that have exhibited blood on them are blood type AB, which actually matches the blood type found in the Shroud of Turin, remarkably. And so that is mind-boggling, and that inspires a lot of faith, or science leading to faith, perhaps. But what about the question of DNA? If the DNA matched from the sample in India and the one in Argentina to the one in Italy to the one in France and Spain and all over the world, if they all matched, wouldn't that convert a few hearts? Wouldn't science bring us to faith in a big way? Well, what's interesting and complicated is that DNA has been attempted to be extracted from these modern Eucharistic miracle samples like Tixla in Mexico. In 2006, the scientists who had that were given that task to extract DNA were not able to. The DNA came up incomplete or corrupted in some way, in such a way that they couldn't get a DNA sequence from it. So this is completely unexpected and unknown why this is. There are different theories about it, of course, but it is true that DNA has not ever been extracted from a Eucharistic miracle sample, despite there being human blood identified and the blood type being able to be identified. So a truly amazing and strange fact as it relates to Eucharistic miracles. So if you have a question for me and would like it answered on the show, send me an email to questions@miraclehunter.com, and maybe I'll be answering your question on the air next week. Let's take a look at the 365 Days with Mary project. We do this every week where we look at the Marian devotion of the day as it relates to how Mary has appeared throughout the world, or a Marian miracle has appeared, or a basilica built, or some other celebration, a feast day, as it lines up to each and every day of the calendar year. And you all know Fatima May 13th, or Lourdes February 11th, or Guadalupe December 12th, but believe it or not, there's a different other Marian devotion that lines up exactly to the day's date. And so for today, we have Our Lady of the Miracle from Motta di Livenza in Italy in the year 1510. The story goes that 79-year-old Giovanni Cigana, he went to get a friend's help with plowing his field on March 9, 1510. When he stopped to pray at a small shrine along the way, he encountered a beautiful girl in white seated on wheat. When it dawned on him that he was speaking to the Mother of God, he fell to his knees. She rose up and asked that he, his family, and the people of Treviso fast for 3 Saturdays in repentance to obtain Christ's pardon for their sins, and that a church be built on the site. Cigana went home and told the story and predicted a solar miracle as Our Lady promised. That evening, the sun appeared blood red. Within a few days, the people of the area had built a wooden church, and the sanctuary celebrates her feast on March 9th.
and that is Our Lady of the Miracle from Motta di Lavenza in Italy in 1510. For more information on this fascinating devotion or any of the hundreds of other Marian devotions from around the world, you can connect to 365dayswithmary.com. You can go to the Facebook page and join 10,000 followers who get a Marian devotion on their Facebook page each and every day, or you can download the free app, 365 Days with Mary, Marian Calendar, on the Apple App Store. Let's take a look at They Might Be Saints. We do this every week where we talk about those people on the path to sainthood, those people who are either servants of God or venerables or blesseds before they have all their miracles declared by Rome to be a saint. And we have a new report coming out. We always try to keep you up to date on the sainthood news, that there's a Filipino catechist now on the road to canonization. This was reported this week by Alitea. And Ca Luring Franco was a saintly lay catechist who died in 2011 at the age of 74. And the local bishop has now officially inaugurated her cause for canonization. Ca Luring Franco dedicated much of her life to being a catechist in the Philippines, and she's remembered as a holy and faithful woman who gave up a well-paying job to become a volunteer catechist. Bishop Milo Hubert Vergara of the Diocese of Pasig, he praised the example of Franco in an interview with UCA News. Ca Luring never tired of serving the parish, especially the poor. She did this in an extraordinary way, but in simple ways, such as teaching faith to children. One becomes like Jesus by teaching about Jesus to others, he said. This is how holiness is reflected in her life, end quote. She said in an interview in 1995, quote, "They couldn't understand it when I explained I was happiest teaching catechism to the children." Now, during her ministry, she received a variety of awards for her dedication, such as the Pro Ecclesia et Pontifice, the highest papal honor for laypeople and clergy, in 1990, as well as the Mother Teresa Award in 2002. And this announcement is the first step in the canonization process. It is now up to the local diocese to investigate her life and to determine if she lived a life of heroic virtue. And if she has one miracle after that, she'll be declared a blessed. A second miracle will make her a saint. But at this point, she's out of the gate as a servant of God, so she's got all the rest of the steps to go. Now let's take a look at the might-be saint of the day, the might-be saint of the day. For today's date, March 9th, we've got Blessed Battista of Florence. And he was a Franciscan friar in the late 15th and early 16th century. And he died in 1510 in Campoli, in the Diocese of Teramo in Italy, of natural causes. As a blessed, he will need one more miracle for Blessed Battista of Florence to become Saint Battista. And he is the might-be saint of the day. And for those people who want to check out the television series on EWTN, this upcoming Wednesday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time, our episode about Father Nelson Baker of They Might Be Saints airs on EWTN television. I'll be examining the canonization cause for Father Nelson Baker. He was a former business owner, and he built the world-class, quote, city of charity with an orphanage, hope for troubled youth, schools, a hospital, and a basilica. His life, in my opinion, and what was one of the most fascinating and amazing lives of any of the might-be saints that we look at on the television series. So check that one out on Wednesday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. They Might Be Saints, Father Nelson Baker. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Dr. Helen Hoffner about her upcoming book, Catholicism Everywhere, from Sophia Institute Press. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. People who tune into this show know that I have a segment that we do every episode called Catholic Pub Trivia. And friends of mine know that I love trivia, and on a random day you might find me in a bar somewhere playing pub trivia. But we talk about Catholic pub trivia on each and every show. And one of the reasons that there is such a thing as Catholic pub trivia, because Catholicism is everywhere. You can find it in every aspect of life, even down to sports, with the Hail Mary pass or the ladybug is named after the Virgin Mary, for example. So we find Catholicism everywhere. And perhaps this isn't a book about miracles, and you know I always have a rule about only featuring things that relate to miracles on this show. But today's a little bit of an exception because we are talking about a new book called Catholicism Everywhere that goes into all the aspects where we see Catholicism represented in our history and culture and even popular culture. We see Catholicism springing up and being well represented because of the great role of Catholicism in human history. And so we're so excited today to be joined by the author of that book that's out from Sophie Institute Press, and that author is Dr. Helen Hoffner. She's the author of Catholic Traditions and Treasures, and also co-author of The Rosary Collector's Guide. You may have seen her on EWTN or various other news outlets, and she's a professor at Holy Family University, where she chairs doctoral dissertation committees and teaches graduate and undergraduate courses. The name of this new book is Catholicism Everywhere. Welcome to the program today, Dr. Helen Hoffner.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Well, I really was excited when I learned about your book, I have to admit. On each and every show, as I mentioned, we do a Catholic Pub Trivia segment, and your book is chock full of Catholic Pub Trivia. I'm pretty sure that some questions coming up on future shows will be derivative of some of the research and things that you've put in this great new book, this hardcover book with beautiful illustrations and photography that's out from Sophia Institute Press. What inspired you to put together this collection of amazing Catholic things?
Well, I started out with the idea that your work is your prayer, that we can't always devote as much time as we like to prayer within a church, but you can do things certainly throughout the day that are prayer. So I started looking for all the connections throughout your day, from things like when you get up in the morning and have a cup of coffee. It was actually Pope Clement VIII in the 16th century who, when world leaders wanted to ban coffee, Pope Clement said no. He tasted it, and he declared it was an acceptable drink for Christians, and actually issued an edict. So I think the idea that there is a Catholic connection to just about every moment of your day.
Yeah, that is amazing. And this book's name is Catholicism Everywhere, which is an apt title because we do find Catholicism everywhere. And now you have so many different ways, and it's almost mind-boggling to see the ways you've organized the book into the ways that Catholicism touches our everyday life. Let's go through some of the sections of that book and talk about some of the things that caught your attention in each. So you start off the book talking about the Catholic calendar. And there are things like feast days, of course, that we're all familiar with, and Pope Gregory the 13th and his calendar, which updated the previous calendar. But what about things like April Fool's Day and Embers Day? What are those, and why do they relate to Catholicism?
And Ember Day was really giving thanks to God for the bountiful times of the earth, just thinking different crops are grown, seasons of the year. So Ember Days were more serious day. April Fool's Day, I think that was the most kind of fun and lightning one for me, that when Pope Gregory did change the calendar, it took a long time for everybody to go along. It's just like in our day to day where people don't agree with things and they want to protest. So originally, the new year started on April 1st. When Pope Gregory's calendar changed to January 1st, there were those who insisted that they were going to keep with their ways, and New Year's Day was April 1st, and they had their celebrations. So over time, the people who insisted on celebrating on April 1st were called April Fools. And that's where we got our April Fool's name from, people who insisted that the new year start on April 1st instead of January 1st, where Pope Gregory wanted it.
Fascinating. It's another section in the book relates to Catholic travel. I do a lot of travel myself, traveling all over the world for EWTN. And I'm always seeking out patron saints for my travel. We've got St. Christopher, and there's that question that pops up all the time and is in your book. St. Christopher, is he still a saint?
You know, he is, and, you know, decades ago when he lost his feast day, actually, when you think about it, there are more than 365 saints and even more people being canonized in our modern time.
Right.
So we can't have a day for each person. But St. Christopher, he's still a saint. He just has to, like some of us have to share our birthday when a new baby is born. He's sharing his day.
Amazing. And then we've got something like Our Lady of the Highway. What can you tell us about her?
That was in the early days when people were just starting to travel in cars. There were two priests who set out, and along the route, they had a horrible accident. And one priest was killed, but his companion who lived, he wanted to honor Mary for saving his life. and he built a statue that he called Our Lady of the Highway. And it's gotten to be a prayer in times that people have prayed to Our Lady in times of trips. I put a picture in the book from high school in the Philadelphia area, St. Hubert's High School, where they have a beautiful statue of Our Lady that originally sat at another church over a highway. And when they moved it to St. Hubert's, it sits over the I-95 intersection. So it's the idea of praying to Mary in your travels.
Amazing. And then you also have a section, Catholics at Sea. So we're talking about Catholics on the road, Catholics at sea. And then you have Catholics in the sky, or traveling the skies, you might say. The Vatican Observatory, of course, maps the sky, and the Pope has broadcasted a message to space. But what about the first bishop of the moon? This caught my attention. I heard this some years ago. I think it's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, and a true story that in the early days of exploration, days of Columbus and the early explorers, the tradition was that the bishop, if Columbus, wherever Columbus sailed from, the bishop of his origin place would be the bishop of the new territory he discovered. So in the 1960s, when we were doing more travel into space, and 1968, when people landed on the moon, the Bishop of Miami told the Pope that he was now the first bishop of the moon because the spaceship landed or left from Florida. So he was now officially the bishop of the moon.
That is amazing. We're talking today with Dr. Helen Hoffner about her brand new book, Catholicism Everywhere. It's out from Sophia Institute Press. And of course, Catholicism has had a major role in healthcare and in education. We see that even in the universities in the United States, but around the world as well. And we talk about textbooks used in Catholic education, cathedral basic readers, Catholic homeschooling. Something that caught my eye was cursive handwriting, the signature of a Catholic school graduate. Tell us a little bit about that.
That was really interesting to me because I've always prided myself on Catholic school cursive handwriting. Mm-hmm. There actually was a man named Palmer, and he was a teacher in a business college. And in those days, it was before typewriters. Typewriters were just starting to be around in the 1800s, but people weren't trained in them. They didn't have typists. So as a business college teacher, his job was teaching his students to write neatly and quickly. He wasn't thinking about children's handwriting at all. But he started working on his system. There was another one called a Spencerian handwriting system that had too many loops and flourishes. Palmer thought he could make it simpler. So he developed his system, wrote newspaper articles about it, and some of the Sisters of the Immaculate Heart of Mary saw his newspaper articles and thought that could work well in their schools. And they actually hired Palmer to come and teach in a summer program for their teachers, for nuns who were preparing to teach in Catholic schools. So Palmer came and he taught these nuns in Michigan to write in his method of Palmer method. And then the sisters said to him, well, we need a textbook. And they helped him publish a textbook. So it really seemed interesting to me that we think of Palmer method being taught to children, but actually it was meant for people in a business college.
Amazing. And one area that we would never think of Catholicism having sort of an impact on, we talk about Catholic fashion. Of course, we all know the Catholic school uniforms. I wore those myself as a youngster. Some people heard in the news of the 2018 Met Gala, where Catholic fashion was on display. But I think maybe the most inspiring story of all is St. Marianne Cope of Molokai in Hawaii, looking out for the people there who are suffering from Hansen's disease or from leprosy, and trying to make them look as good as they possibly could by bringing in some of the fashions of the day. Talk a little bit about St. Marianne Cope, please.
Yes, Sister Marianne Cope, she was a nun, so she wore traditional habits as a nun would. But she was working with Father Damien, helping him to bring care to the lepers. And when she arrived in this place, what really struck her was that the women looked really very sad and depressed. And they were wearing just clothes that she described as just kind of rags, just nothing inspiring. And she thought, you know, anyone feels better when they're wearing something that they feel proud of. When you dress better, you kind of feel better and have that confidence. So Sister Marianne Cope, she thought, just as important as bringing health care to these women, she made sure they had pretty dresses. And she raised funds. She got people to help her so that these women who were dealing with leprosy would have a very beautiful dress to wear. And she found that as their appearance brightened, it really improved their health also.
Wonderful. And we talk about things like weather, another area where we think maybe Catholicism doesn't impact in any way, but there is this thing, this phenomena called St. Elmo's fire, which is a remarkable thing for people who know about it. What is this sign of hope for sailors?
And, you know, people maybe in recent years heard St. Elmo's fire because it was a movie and you hear the song on the radio. But what it really was a type of lightning that sailors would see during a storm that would be a very, very bad storm. Near the end of the storm, there were these balls of fire that didn't look like traditional lightning strikes. It looked like a round ball of fire that would come at the end of the storm. And the sailors, when the storm was very difficult, they would pray to St. Elmo to bring them through the storm safely. And near the end of the storm, if they saw these balls of fire, they would say, oh, St. Elmo heard our prayer. The storm's going to end soon. So what St. Elmo's fire really is are these balls of fire that appear in the sky as lightning near the end of a storm.
Amazing. And I mentioned before, we talked about God's creatures. We can talk about the ladybug, perhaps, as getting its name or relating to the Virgin Mary. And we talk about hunters might have a devotion to St. Hubert. And there is various other ways of St. Bridget and the Fox and others that you have listed here. One that's fascinating to me, because I have encountered these monkeys during my travels, Capuchin monkeys. Talk a little bit why they're called Capuchins, and how does that relate, if it does in any way, to the drink cappuccinos?
And they relate to the drink because it all came from the same source, the same name. The Capuchin monkeys, if you look at them, they're sort of a light brown shade, and the spot on the top of their head was sort of brown. And early explorers thought that, gee, it reminded them of Capuchin monks in the robes that they wear. So they named the monkeys that. And then the drink, way back in history, it was a time when the Christians were fighting the Ottomans. And when the Christian forces won, and they went into some of the territory, there were all these bags of coffee that had been left. And when they wanted to use the coffee, these particular coffee beans were extremely strong. So one of the monks who was there added some spices, and he added lots and lots of milk. And the coffee turned the same, that light shade of brown that Capuchin monks wear. So what we would now call a drink of cappuccino was inspired by the color of the Capuchin monks' robe, just like the color of the monkey's fur was the same color as the Capuchin monk. So their name has been used a lot of places in the world.
Absolutely. Yeah, this book is incredible. Your knowledge is incredible of all the ways Catholicism has impacted the world, both in namesakes and otherwise, influence in a big way. We're talking today with Dr. Helen Hoffner about her book, Catholicism Everywhere, from Sophia Institute Press. And I don't have a green thumb, so I've always thought a Mary Garden would be a nice thing to do, but maybe that's not for me. But your book talks about various ways that we see Catholicism as it relates to various flowers and things of this nature. And I'm more of a sports guy, so I'm going to ask you, you have a whole section devoted to sports. We have a St. Rita connection to baseball, but I also want to know about that famous phrase, the Hail Mary Pass. Why does that phrase exist like that?
And that Roger Staubach is the one who gave us that phrase. And it was during a 1975 playoff game when he was playing in the NFL. And he says now, or what he said, you know, after it got kind of famous, that what he really was doing was praying that his team would win. He wanted to do absolutely everything he could to get his team to win. So he just prayed and prayed and prayed that his pass was going to work. And he said, and I said a Hail Mary, and I was successful. He says, actually, it could have been a Glory Be pass. It could have been an Our Father pass. But that day I said a Hail Mary, and it got me on Mary's good side.
There you go. That's an incredible story, and one of the very famous phrases that relate to Catholicism. This book is chock full of phrases that have connections to Catholicism and the influence of Catholicism in various ways. And other sections of the book look at weddings, Catholics in the military, Catholic organizations, and Catholic roots of common expressions, which is one of my favorite parts of the book. And so as we wrap up the interview today, I want to ask, where can people get this book, and where can they find out more about you?
Well, the most direct place to get the book is on the website for Sophia Institute. If they just go to sophiainstitute.com, that would be their best way. I'm happy to be a professor at Holy Family University in Philadelphia, so they can find me there on the website that way.
Wonderful. Well, we're so grateful to you, Dr. Helen Hoffner, for putting together this fun book. And like I say, we do Catholic trivia on each and every show, and I'm quite sure that we'll be finding some inspiration for new questions coming from this book, Catholicism Everywhere, out from Sophia Institute Press. Thank you so much, Dr. Helen Hoffner, for joining us on today's program.
Oh, my pleasure.
And that was Dr. Helen Hoffner talking about her book, Catholicism Everywhere. Check that one out. It's a fun one. It's chock full of things related to Catholicism and how it's impacted society from the big, the lady, from the Hail Mary pass, you might say, down to the small, to the ladybug. And that's all the time we have for today's show. If you missed any of this episode or want to catch up on past episodes, you can go to EWTN.com/radio, check out the audio archives, or download the free EWTN app. I'd like to thank our guest today, Dr. Helen Hoffner, talking to us about Catholicism Everywhere, and also author John Clark for shedding some light on that mysterious staircase of St. Joseph. Check out a brand new episode of Explore with the Miracle Hunter. We're in a streak of some new episodes coming out on EWTN, coming up on Saturday the 16th at 5 p.m. Central Time. The Church of Rocamadour houses an image and bell that, according to legend, mysteriously rings out to herald miracles happening on the high seas. I'll be investigating that one. That's Explore with the Miracle Hunter on Rocamadour, and that's Saturday the 16th at 5 p.m. Central Time. And I'd like to thank you for joining me today on Miracle Hunter, where from claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt. Talk to you next week.